From KUOW in Seattle, this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. And this week, Soundside is on summer break. Some of the team are on vacation. Others are working hard on future shows. But that doesn't mean we're leaving you out in the cold. Today, we're airing the final episode of our series, A More Perfect Union, created with our partners at Spokane Public Radio, Northwest Public Broadcasting, and Humanities Washington. You can hear our first two episodes over at our website, kuow.org/soundside. I'm going to let Doug and Sue Ann take it from here.
I'm Doug Nadvornik from Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Sue Ann Ramella from Northwest Public Broadcasting. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
These are the first 52 words of the U.S. Constitution. This program is about four of them, a more perfect union, and how Native people in the Northwest have sought to create a more perfect union for their people and their communities. For Native Americans, it's been a road lined with treaties, broken promises, and wars, says University of Washington history professor Josh Reed.
Basically, you know, if we think back to kind of the long history of the relationship between Native nations and the United States, the U.S. has always talked about there being an Indian problem, and that namely being that American Indians continued to survive and, you know, they were kind of in the way of American progress in, you know, a variety of different, very problematic ways. So there were always these federal kind of policies of how are we going to solve the Indian problem?
Reed teaches a course that examines how the U.S. government, in creating opportunities for white settlers, drove tribes to reservations that were much smaller than their ancestral homelands. And he examines how the government rounded up Native children and forced them to live in boarding schools in order to assimilate them into American culture.
And so I like to kind of turn things on their head. And, you know, really what it is American Indians have had an American problem.
You'll hear more from Josh Reed from the University of Washington later in the program, but next, we turn to another academic, Dr. Cheryl Ellenwood from Washington State University's School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs, Center for Native American Research and Collaboration. What does a more perfect union mean to you?
Yeah, when I thought about the idea of a more perfect union, I had to Google it and look it up because it doesn't currently exist for me right now. I think right now we have a somewhat functioning government across federal and state levels. Whether it's a perfect union, I don't think so, because so many people have been left out. I cannot speak for everyone, but I do see through my research that political indigenous representation does matter. It matters that we have Secretary Deborah Holland in the cabinet right now making decisions, calling for reports on boarding school. And hopefully we will continue to get awareness of that and action policy made to reconcile the wrongs of our government's history toward Native peoples. But it's not just indigenous representation at colonial governments at the federal state levels. It's also coming to the table, say state governments, federal government, coming to the table side by side with Native nations. Those are tribal governments who have the sovereign authority to self-determine who they are, how they manage their affairs, and they need to be able to do that. That's another finding we found in our research, my co-authors and I, was that tribes have to be able to say who gets to come on our land because these are our citizens. Tribes can initiate policy that closes borders to protect their people. And when tribes don't have the authority to do that, they don't have the authority to keep their people safe. And so really it's, again, indigenous representation, it's political participation of Native nations with other governments like federal and state, But it's also trusting the communities. Native communities have been managing their forests and their land since time immemorial. We've seen traditional ecological knowledge really come to the forefront of a lot of conversations about climate change. Trusting these communities, and this is not in particular to just Native communities, but trusting the local people who have managed their affairs, I think will help create a greater conversation for a more inclusive union.
Dr. Ellenwood, what can people do in your communities that you represent and work with? What could they do to work towards a more perfect union?
Does this mean everyone or Indigenous peoples? For Indigenous peoples, they are doing the work, right? They've been intentionally left out of certain services, and they've been targeted through policies of cultural genocide. I think we need allies to stand up and let us speak and manage our own affairs, whether that's voting, showing up, voting for diverse representation at all levels. But really, it's about Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination. And so Native nations, Native American, Alaska Native peoples here in the U.S. and across the world are fighting to survive in our own way, to maintain our culture. And Indigenous people have been doing that. That is something they're working to preserve and working to educate people who are, say, citizens of their tribal nations, and going off to school and coming back and contributing to their nation, for their people, for the collective. Most Native students that I teach are there to better themselves, but they're also there to better their communities. And so when I'm teaching Introduction to Tribal Nation Building and we're discussing tribal nations, Native nations across the U.S., having sovereign authority to manage their own affairs and decide what they want to pursue in economic development, cultural activities, language preservation. They need their citizens, their youth, to go to school and come back and serve their people.
Dr. Ellenwood, what can politicians do to better represent the communities that they serve?
I think that many Native nations and Indian people within the U.S. want politicians to advocate for sovereignty. I mean, it's a broken record, but they want to be able to manage their own affairs. And so everyone in politics, I think, can listen. They can also be allies, whether they're voting, the policies that they're making can be in support of Native communities. And again, that's not something very specific to Native communities. They should be in support and aligned with community needs across all levels, whether that's the Black community, Latinx community, Native communities, LGBTQ communities. They need to be able to be responsive.
So if you're a representative or a congressperson, do you just show up and then call it good and you're representing?
I think a lot of work needs to be done to improve the relationship between politicians and their constituents, right? Politicians and Native nations. There's supposed to be a consultation that occurs between sovereign entities. That consultation might be lip service at some times. Others, it will be active listening sessions where dialogue and exchange is occurring. But really, decision makers need to be at the table with other decision makers, whether that's politicians and tribal leaders. They need to be engaged in meaningful dialogue to really achieve a more perfect union.
Dr. Ellenwood is an assistant professor at WSU's School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs, Center for Native American Research and Collaboration. She wrote a paper called Whose Voice to Trust? Native American Representation, Political Power, and the COVID-19 Pandemic. The rocky history between tribes in the United States has had positive developments, too. In 1975, Congress approved the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. That allowed tribes as sovereign nations to negotiate for services with the federal government. It gave them opportunities to rebuild and reconnect with their traditions. That law took effect 1 year after another one for tribes when Washington's Supreme Court issued the Bolt decision, which ruled that Indian nations, through their treaties with the federal government, have the right to fish in their historic places and catch half of the harvest allowed by the state. This was the beginning of a resurgence in Indian country, says Leonard Forsman. He's the chair of the Suquamish tribe and the president of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians.
Self-Determination Act in the 1970s brought back some of our programs back to the tribe. And then the Bolt decision, which established our fisheries department and provided opportunity for our people to resume their treaty fishing, has had a huge impact because it brought more people back to the tribe because there was an opportunity to make a living, either working for the tribe or fishing for the tribe or et cetera, created a tribal economy. So once that happened, we were able to, spend more time planning for our future. And I think the three things that we did, one was planning for a cultural preservation, our museum, our archives, and ceremonial life. And since then, that's had a great resurgence in our cultural presence and activities and material culture and songs and dance groups and ceremonial activities, all those things. Second thing was economic. Started out with fishing, shellfish, and then we've branched out. Of course, gaming has been something that's super important, and then expanding that out. And then some of our tax revenue agreements with the state. I think the third thing would be just our ability to get out there and act as a member of the family of governments.
The revival of the Suquamish tribe on the Kitsap Peninsula has similarities to the story of the Kalispell tribe, whose homeland is a small reservation in Ponderay County in northeastern Washington. Glenn Nenema has been its chairman since the late 1970s, back when the community didn't have much going for it.
There was no economic development. Healthcare, what was there was very little and wasn't enough to take care of our people. We never had insurance. We relied on Indian Health Service. No land base. Half of the reservation, it was 4,700 acres. Half of it was in the floodplain. The other half was hillside. There were challenges for us as a small tribe.
In 1998, the Kalispells got their big break. The U.S. Interior Department approved the tribe's application for a gaming compact. That cleared the way for the Kalispells to build an off-reservation casino, Northern Quest, on trust land in Airway Heights, just west of Spokane. The casino and related nearby businesses employ several hundred people. The tribe is now expanding its hotel there.
Are you pleased with how Northern Quest has grown and developed?
It's probably, for me, it's almost enough, yeah.
Almost enough?
Yeah, I mean, when the hotel's done, then I think I'd like to see us, we're concentrating on a lot more up here.
Up here is the tribe's reservation near the towns of Cusick and Usk. The Ponderay County population is only about 12,000, so Nenema says the economic opportunities are limited. As you look out the window from where we're talking, you see several dozen buffalo grazing in a field, part of the tribe's plan to develop a butcher shop and meat processing facility. Nenema says the Kalispells have other projects under development as well.
Right now, we just recently visited a couple of the tribes on the west side that are doing opiate clinics, which we're researching them right now. We're going to do a treatment, for addictions here, 32-bed. And we're also looking into some of the, new technologies, things that we're thinking could take us into, way down, so many generations.
One symbol of the Kalispell's success is the state-of-the-art wellness facility next door to the tribal headquarters. It's complete with pool, fitness center, and medical and dental clinic.
We're able to provide education, health for our people, homes, jobs, early childhood development, our language. We have many teachers now in the language. We were able to develop curriculum just for to teach the language.
That focus on education extends past high school.
Today, I don't know how many people are in higher education, but it's more than ever. And that's our own funding. It's like full scholarships to our young people. We had one young lady graduate from Stanford. That's our future.
Glenn Nenema says the Kalispell tribe isn't yet self-sufficient and may never be, but it's in a better place than it was when he first began leading the tribal council more than 40 years ago.
I think things are starting to where we can pick and choose what we want to do. Before, we were always, let's say, with the bank kind of controlled us, you know. Now we're better shaped to where we can pick and choose. We can also pick, you know, not to do anything.
With that financial stability has come respect from the outside.
Has the attitude toward the tribe changed over the years as a partner?
When you have money, yes, politicians pay a little more attention to you. That's how I see it working. When we had nothing, we were nobody.
Glenn Nenema is the chairman of the Kalispell tribe. Next, we talk with three attorneys about some of the legal issues concerning Native tribes. This is A More Perfect Union from Northwest Public Broadcasting, KUOW, Spokane Public Radio, and Humanities Washington.
I'm Sue Ann Romella from Northwest Public Broadcasting. University of Washington professor Eric Eberhard has practiced law for 52 years, 50 in the field of American Indian law. To show you how extensive this field is, he says the U.S. government has negotiated about 900 treaties with tribes. About 400 were ratified by the Senate. Eberhard says there are volumes of federal and state law that pertain to tribes.
I think of the tribes as the most regulated entities in the United States. Some folks in the private sector would probably disagree with that, but I would welcome them to measure side by side the law that applies to them compared to the law that applies to the tribes. There's nothing quite like it. The tribes are separate sovereigns. They're recognized in the Constitution as separate sovereigns. They were recognized as separate sovereigns going clear back to the colonial era. And for the most part, they retain important aspects of that separate sovereignty right to today. If you are a citizen of a tribe, you are subject to the laws of the tribe, and the tribe has the inherent power to enact its own laws and to apply them on the territories of the tribe. The extent of the tribal ability to do that with respect to non-native people who may be in tribal territory has been limited by decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, but the tribes do enjoy that authority in civil matters and even in some criminal matters through legislation enacted by the Congress that affirms the right of the tribes to exercise that authority. It's a complex situation, and it will vary from tribe to tribe, state to state, depending on the particular unique history of the tribe and the state, and the particular unique history of the way in which the tribe was recognized by the United States as a separate sovereign.
Is there a lot of difference in that?
Oh yeah, a tribe in Maine is gonna have a whole different set of recognized inherent powers compared to a tribe here in Washington State.
From the tribe's point of view, what's good and what's bad about tribal sovereignty?
I think tribes would uniformly agree that what's good is their ability to control their own affairs among their own people on their own lands. I think what they would agree is not good and not helpful is the tendency of the Supreme Court to limit the extent of the authority of the tribes in their own territories. And that has had profound impacts. For example, if you're a non-native and you come onto the reservation and you engage in a criminal act, with a very few exceptions, you're not going to be subject to tribal jurisdiction. You are subject to federal jurisdiction, but federal law enforcement in Indian country is all but non-existent. So you have a whole class of people in Indian country, mostly women, but it does include some men, children, and elders who are victimized by non-native people in various ways and who can get away with it because there's a vacuum of law enforcement. It's a serious problem.
Are there particular open questions, let's say, the lawyers talk about right now that are unsettled with regard to native country?
Yeah. Most tribes would like to convince Congress to completely restore inherent tribal jurisdiction over non-natives, civil and criminal. So that's always an issue that's out there. The question of where tribal water rights are adjudicated is one that's always difficult for the tribes. Congress enacted a law in the early 1950s that vested the state courts with jurisdiction to determine tribal water rights. Tribes would much prefer to have those adjudicated in federal court than state court. And then the Indian Child Welfare Act, there are challenges to it in state and federal courts that are very vexatious for the tribes and have a profoundly negative effect on the ability of Native parents to raise their children in Native cultures.
I assume that relationship with Congress kind of ebbs and flows. What's your perspective as to what the trajectory is?
It's always on a razor's edge. It's always what will happen next. Who's in control and what are they likely to do? It's a perennial question. And can we hold on to the gains that we've made? Much less, can we keep pushing forward? So that's just a fact of life in Indian country. That uncertainty is always there. And I think it will be until more generations have had the opportunity to see the world through the eyes of a place where they have a functioning government, is responsive to their needs, and they can see real positive changes in education, healthcare, employment, so on and so forth. We still have about half of Indian country that lives in third world conditions. And so that's always there. It's always a reminder. It's slowly changing, but it hasn't changed enough to give people confidence that what's happened really the last 40 years is real and it's going to be something that can be sustained over time.
Eric Eberhard is an affiliate assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Law.
Now, Eric is not Native American, even though he practiced tribal law for half a century. Neither is Lorraine Parlange. She is the senior attorney for the Kalispell tribe based in the Spokane area. Before that, she represented the Spokane tribe and quickly learned that there are differences between state and tribal courts.
My experience beginning as a young attorney working in a tribal court, I had the honor to appear before Judge Conrad Pascal of the Spokane tribe. And very quickly, he let me know when I was first beginning that what I had learned in law school and the way I was practicing in state court was not conducive to the way he was running his court and the need for tribal members and other people in the community and family members to be heard. So there definitely are differences. The main one being, from my perspective, that it's less adversarial. Each tribe is unique. But many tribes do have their own tribal courts. Some of them have very extensive tribal codes and regulations and ways to administer them. Some of them may have different constitutions different ways that their courts are set up. And so the tribal court, in some ways, there are similarities in that you will have due process, notice, and an opportunity to be heard. It will be different in some ways, in my experience, in that it's less adversarial. It is not set up so much to have lawyers running the show directly. It's really to do a lot more problem solving. I think it depends, of course, on the type of case.
Parlange advises Kalispell tribal leaders on a variety of issues, including those negotiated with other governments, including tax compacts. According to the Washington Department of Revenue, the state has negotiated tax compacts with 9 tribes, including the Kalispells.
Taxation for all governments is an integral source of funding, and so sometimes some states will view transactions that occur on tribal lands as an area where they have an ability to tax non-tribal developments. So this can result in the dual taxation. So an example would be a business that is a non-tribal business that is operating in tribal land. They, prior to the compacts, and even the compacts didn't address all the taxation issues, but those businesses were having to collect state tax and remit tax back to the state, even though they were on tribal lands, and even though it was the tribe that was providing, for some tribes, exclusively providing services to those communities. So if the tribes, who also, like other sovereigns, have the ability to tax, if they would impose a tax, it would result in businesses having to pay 2 taxes, a state tax and a tribal tax. So a pretty untenable situation for tribes to be put in, and so often it, in order for them to have economic development, they just didn't impose a tribal tax. They have to forego the ability to do some of their own tribal taxation. And yet continue to provide services. So I think the tribal-state compacts that have been recently entered into in the last couple of years are a great step forward.
And allow tribes and states to share tax revenues, whereas it all used to go to the state.
I think moving forward in terms of more agreements to better enhance the tribal communities and the surrounding communities, the understanding of where revenue goes, how it's being used, and a lot more collaboration, I think, will benefit all and allow for greater economic development, because being able to do business in Indian Country brings so many great opportunities for businesses. I think tribes have really moved in the direction to expand, and I think there have been changes also in federal laws to allow maybe for that to be a little bit more user-friendly. But I think as more businesses do that and they see the great driving engines that tribes are and their ability to do business, I think that will also see an expansion.
Lorraine Parlange is the senior attorney for the Kalispell Tribe. And now we're going to touch on one other important issue in tribal courts, cases that involve domestic and sexual violence, especially against women. For that, we turn to Tommy Miller, whose firm Metau Law in Omak works with tribes, including the Colville Confederated Tribes.
By and large, tribes don't have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, meaning that people will come and target tribal members, tribal women, because they know that the only prosecutorial fear that they might have is from the federal government. And the federal government is often not interested in investigating and prosecuting these kinds of cases. So it creates this huge jurisdictional loophole that makes it very hard to actually take direct legal action to stop these things. So in 2013, Congress passed a law that gave tribes additional criminal jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders in domestic violence situations, but only if the tribes had certain tribal codes in place, like code of evidence and certain other written tribal procedural codes, essentially.
Writing tribal codes is one of the services Miller provides for tribes, in this case, the Colvilles.
The tribe contracted with me to develop this victim rights code. It's sort of analogous in some ways to how defendants in criminal cases have the Bill of Rights to protect their rights. But in the absence of a victim rights code, there's really no or very few rights for the victim to be informed about the progress of the case, to be protected and have as much security and comfort and autonomy in participating in the process as they would like, and rights to be consulted on the progress of the case and the direction of the case. I think it's interesting because you have to walk a line there, not interfering with defendants' rights, not interfering with the effective prosecution or defense of a case, but otherwise trying to give victims as much autonomy and as much rights as possible in the system.
Earlier, Lorraine Parlange told us that many tribes are becoming less adversarial in dealing with certain types of cases, and Tommy Miller agrees with that. He says some tribes are shifting their focus toward healing.
So, for instance, the Colville tribe has the Peacekeeper's Circle. It's an alternative dispute resolution mechanism that tries to focus on healing the community, bringing the perpetrator and the victim together to discuss what happened and how the community could move forward and heal, essentially, rather than the purely punitive sending someone to jail for an arbitrary amount of time and hoping that when they come back, everything is better.
That's important, Miller says, on smaller reservations.
A lot of tribal communities are very close-knit. I mean, the Colville tribe is 10,000 members, about 5,000 of whom live on the reservations in, I would say, four main communities. So it's not a huge population. You know your neighbors and you know your family, like family friends going back generations. So this idea of wanting to heal the community after something happens is, I think, more attractive than if it's just a stranger had broken into your house and stolen something.
That's Tommy Miller from Metau Law in OMAC. We'll turn to education next and teaching Washington children about tribal history. You're listening to A More Perfect Union. Since 2015, the Washington state government has required school districts to teach children about tribal history. Teachers must use a curriculum called Since Time Immemorial, Tribal Sovereignty in Washington State, which you can find on the state school superintendent's website.
Here in the rich forest of the Pacific Northwest, rivers flow from the mountains. They wind through the forest, through the meadows, through the estuaries, and human neighborhoods to the Puget Sound and the sea.
This video, called Through Salmon Eyes, produced by the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, is one option for teachers. Also available is a related group of studies called Native Knowledge 360. It's created by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. Laura Lynn is the program supervisor in Washington's Office of Native Education for the state school superintendent. Why is this important for children who are not natives to understand this history?
One is that we recognize all of our children are our leaders. We are leaders within our families, we're leaders within our schools, within our communities. As we enter into leadership, it begins with us being informed citizens. That begins by knowing our history. And our history begins with tribal history, right? And then it's learning about the experiences of each of us in order to understand and grow. There's a lot of misunderstanding with non-tribal students in terms of who tribal people are. In some instances for our students, it's potentially stereotypes from the media that portray tribal people, sometimes in very disrespectful ways, other times just in inaccurate ways, and not knowing the people who are the nearest neighbors, which is the tribes nearest to them. And to be able to see and understand tribal people as contemporary peoples rather than as people of the past. Some of our students, without this kind of learning, they don't know that tribal people are here today. It also helps to break down stereotypes and misconceptions that are foundation for discrimination.
Each school district is required to work with the nearest tribe to tailor a district's lesson plans to make them as local as possible.
The Tulalip tribes are bringing, they have a consortium of all of their districts that are close to them, who come together regularly to learn together, write curriculum together, and then provide, you know, the pathways for professional learning. Professional learning is foundational to this work. Our educators are needing to deepen their understanding about tribal history and tribal sovereignty, even as they're preparing and providing instruction with their students. The Spokane Tribe of Indians has developed a Spokane Tribal Lifeways curriculum that is Spokane-specific.
The Spokane School District teaches the Since Time Immemorial curriculum. It also has a program that provides support for Native students. Spokane has a large urban Indian population. Heather Lemery is the chairwoman of the school district's Indian Education Advisory Council.
We do things as small as, like, does a kid need school supplies? Can their family not afford that? Or is a kid having issues at the school and they just need help to kind of navigate how to get through those issues with the school? Sometimes administrations in the schools isn't always the easiest to navigate, and some parents just don't know how to navigate that. Or some of them are scared to stand up for what is right for their student in the school.
Has it been an effective program?
Yes and no. I feel like there's kind of pros and cons to everything we do. So for those parents that are willing to ask for help, we've been able to get in there and help them. But there's so many parents out there that don't know what their rights are or what they can and can't do, that they just never ask for help. They just do whatever the school tells them they have to do, which isn't always what we would think of as fair.
So make the case for why these programs are needed. For parents who might say, you know, why do we have an Indian education program? What's the argument you would make?
Oh, I have a lot of arguments. I just feel like so strongly that, I mean, people have different learning styles. Plus, there's so many things that our families have been put through as far as, I mean, our land was taken from us. People came in, took over, put us in the kind of schools they wanted us in. And I'm sure everybody's heard about the boarding school thing lately. Put us into boarding schools, made us learn their languages, took away our traditions, didn't let us practice our traditions. So that has had a big impact on our Native community. And it's broken a lot of trust with families and schools. So sometimes either Native kids will either one of two things. They'll get defensive about it on when a school district is telling them they have to do something. They'll just get defensive, dig their heels in, and then they get kicked out. Or they will go the total opposite way and just do whatever the school district tells them, even if it's not always fair. So this committee is necessary to help them navigate that and to kind of stand up for the rights of these Native families and help people to realize that there are trust issues there. There's also different learning styles. Native kids aren't always raised the same as other kids. We have different traditions. We have different things that we do, and our learning style is not always the same. So creating the programs necessary for these kids, incorporating their culture and traditions into their education is going to be what creates the highest success rate for these kids.
Heather Lemery is the chairwoman of the Indian Education Advisory Council for the Spokane School District.
And you're listening to our final episode of A More Perfect Union on Soundside on KUOW. This is Libby Dankman. Before we finish today's episode, we want to take a moment to highlight how one Washingtonian is thinking about changing our political system. They sat down with Nikki Brueggemann with Humanities Washington to discuss what, to them, would create a more perfect union.
Pasco, Washington is located on the lands of the Umatilla, Walla Walla, and Cayuse people, and the lands of the Confederate tribes and bands of the Yakima Nation. How do I describe Pasco? Well, it's part of something called the Tri-Cities, which is composed of three cities, Kennewick, Richland, and Pasco. If you're from the area, you tend to talk about the Tri-Cities as a monolith. After all, when driving through the Tri-Cities, you often don't know that you have left one city and you have entered another. That being said, Pasco and the Tri-Cities are home to queerness, and they have a vibrant community that loves to celebrate who it is. Activist Carly Coburn lives in Pasco and has been an advocate for disabled rights, queer rights, and many other issues in their community.
My name is Carly Coburn, and I live in Pasco, Washington.
So we live in a country where we are constantly told we have rights. Things like the right to free speech, the right to vote, the right to a fair trial. And these are held within documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. However, many communities and people feel that these rights are not accessible to them. So as a queer person, how do you feel about these documents? And do you feel they offer you the protection and support you need in your life?
I believe that all those constitutions should be living documents and that they should be changed frequently as needed to reflect the realities of the society that we live in at the time. You know, we weren't or are still not able to ratify the ERA, the Equal Rights Act, and it doesn't seem to matter who holds which, the House or the Senate or the executive branches. We've had the Equality Act, which is an act that would adds very similar verbiage as the Equal Rights Act, but it includes gender representation and how you present yourself as well. So a little bit extra protections, but it's never been passed. You know, we have approved legal slavery in the Declaration of Independence still, even though it was supposed to be outlawed. States, constitutions, you know, fortunate to live in Washington in some aspects because our Constitution holds certain protections that even the federal government, even the Constitution of the United States doesn't afford us. I think that the documents, you know, every state's constitution, the Constitution of the United States, I feel they're all incomplete. Mm-hmm. And that they should be so badly reviewed and that they should change with the times. It's not something that should be, it's not a memorial, it's not a statue that is, you know, just sat there to remind us of something. It's a legal document that influences courts, and it should reflect what we are today.
So I'm going to follow up a little bit more because we were discussing these documents. Now, the Declaration of Independence says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." As a disabled queer person, what do you believe would allow you to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Freedom of movement. There's the assumption that I would have the freedom of movement, but in December, me and my spouse were in Portland, and we were using the curb cuts. And one of them was so badly done that he literally almost threw me into moving traffic.
Oh my goodness.
And it's not funny. I laughed because I cried at the time and I don't want to again. I'd love to see the Americans with Disabilities Act turned into being used for more than it is. You know, in Tri-Cities, there was a gentleman from Spokane who filed complaints against several local places that he did not have freedom of movement in because he couldn't access the buildings at all. And through lawsuit, he was able to now because they had to make changes. I'm not able to safely move about. I don't have guaranteed access to healthcare. I have such a list of medical conditions and things that I'm seen for, but I'm fully reliant on my spouse because I can't work. And so he has to work even more than he might normally, just so that we can afford my prescriptions. It's hard to be happy or feel liberated when, you know, you worry about your rent also. It would just have to be such a drastic overhaul that I almost actually can't imagine how it would feel to have those specific words from the Declaration of Independence actually have meaning within my life.
Do you have any hopes for how the queer community, for how the disabled community, how they interact with democracy in the future?
Yes, I'd love to see, you know, candidates who care enough to make accessible websites for queer folks. It would help if queer rights on any level weren't sometimes considered spots to be lenient and to maybe not fight as hard. Like, oh, maybe if we give this one, then we'll get this thing instead. I know that the Democratic Party is called the big umbrella a lot of times, but sometimes they forget that near the edge of the umbrella, people are getting wet still. And that the ones on the edges are the ones who probably need more help and more support. So there's no guarantee for queer folks that the Democratic Party, local, sometimes even statewide, is actually going to be welcoming to them. So I think the Democratic Party would have to do a lot of trust building for both the disabled and the queer community.
That was Carly Coburn speaking with Nikki Brueggemann.
We finish this program where we started with Josh Reed from the University of Washington History Department. You remember, he's the professor who teaches a class called Inconvenient Indians and the American Problem. He's a registered member of the Snohomish Indian Nation. He likes to teach how Indigenous people have endured and thrived.
I tend to have people focus on resilience, the way that our communities have been resilient in the face of settler colonialism, the way that our communities strive for resilience amidst catastrophic climate change. You know, it's not going to wipe us out or wipe our people out because we're resilient. It's just another challenge of many that we are going to need to face. And it's closely tied to the big challenge that we've been facing for a long time, colonialism. You know, when I look at kind of the state of Native nations, say over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, I focus on things like the resurgence of canoe journeys. You know, I think that that is a signature example of not just, you know, Coast Salish and Northwest Coast cultural revival, but there's also a lot of governance and, you know, kind of Native government to Native government relations that are interwoven within canoe journeys as our peoples interact across lines of protocol, being welcomed into from one host community to another as they're traveling along canoe journeys. All the language that has, you know, really been revitalized because of canoe journeys, so that speakers on the canoes can go through the right protocol systems in Lushootseed and other indigenous languages of this region. Food sovereignty is another big piece. I'm thinking of the incredible native garden that Valerie Seacrest down at Muckleshoot has been working on for a number of years. You know, even things like macaw whaling relate to food sovereignty, the Lummi's efforts at, you know, their shellfish hatchery that provides millions of seed gooey ducks and clams to other Native nations and commercial operators. Those are markers also of food sovereignty, economic development, and resilience. You know, even something controversial, say, like gaming revenues, the ways that Native nations have used that money to, you know, support Native students here at the University of Washington, to provide for their elders, to mitigate the COVID disaster that unfolded in some of our communities in particularly catastrophic ways. Communities here seem to navigate that pretty well, and that's a marker of sovereignty and self-determination, that some of the decisions that they made with that, you know, and the ability to do that because they've got some of their own economic development money that they can use to support their peoples, to practice sovereignty, you know, on a day-to-day basis in a very kind of, you know, quotidian way. You know, that's all really important. Those are the types of things that I tend to look at when I try to assess kind of the state of Native nations today.
That's Professor Josh Reed from the University of Washington. The Census Bureau reports that in 2020, about 9.7 million people in the United States identified in some way as American Indian and/or Alaskan Native.
This hour of A More Perfect Union was produced by Spokane Public Radio and Northwest Public Broadcasting in cooperation with KUOW and Humanities Washington. I'm Sue Ann Ramella.
And I'm Doug Nadvornik.
Thanks for listening to Soundside today. I hope you're having a great start to your summer. We'll be airing archives of our favorite shows the rest of this week. See you soon on the radio or on your podcast feed.